Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the National Judicial College for allowing us to have this unique experience of actual case before the this panel, the Northern Panel of the Nevada Supreme Court. My name is Michael Cherry. I've been a justice on the Supreme Court since 2007. To my right is Justice Mark Gibbons, and to my left is Justice Michael Douglas. Also, I'd like to share with you some other people. The jury sitting here happens to be the law clerks for Justice Gibbons and myself. We've got Chelsea Lancaster and Tom Stewart, who are Justice Gibbons' law clerks. So why don't you stand still? And my law clerks are here, James Dunn and Lee Gorland. And also, I'd like to introduce our clerks of the Supreme Court. Our assistant clerk is Harry Cummings. She's a lawyer also. And our newest clerk of the court will be taking over sometime in October. Elizabeth Brown, who's also a lawyer and is an expert in capital murder cases. Did a lot of work as a staff attorney. Now she's the head clerk of the Supreme Court. Also, our marshals are here. We've got Travis Hughes and Chris Arroyo are here. And the ladies over here are recorders. Are Joan Hendricks and Dana Richards. So that's the group. Before we get started, I'd like to just give some information. First of all, is Rachel here from the stage, Rush? Where is she? She's not here yet. She was going to interview and I promised her we'd take a picture with her. First of all, I'm going to ask Justice Douglas to explain how we get to this point of oral argument in the Supreme Court. Justice Douglas?
Well, thank you, Chief, but we'll reverse this. Oh, Justice Gibbons.
I'm sorry, you're right. This right and left stuff is right here. Justice Gibbons, will you do that? That's how we get to oral argument.
Okay, well, thank you, Justice Cherry. Basically, what we do is after, in the case goes to district court and judgment standard, either party can appeal. They have 30 days to file a notice of appeal. And once the notice of appeal is filed, the parties have an opportunity to brief the case and the issues. And the appellant would file two briefs. The respondent would file one brief, one answering brief. And then that's when we get involved. At that point in time, the court clerk and the chief justice will go through all the cases that have finished briefing and they'll determine if the cases should be sent to the en banc court, which is only seven justices, or if it's a case that could be handled by a panel of three justices. Again, because of the large volume of cases we have, we have to divide them up to speed up the process and get the cases resolved. So that's the chief justice's decision. Then once they determine if they should go to a panel, then what happens then is we have two panels. One panel hears exclusively cases out of Clark County out of Las Vegas. The second panel, which we are this particular year, and the panels change every year, we hear all cases throughout the rest of the state. And since about 70% of the appeals come from Clark County, we also hear some Clark County cases as well. So we have a mix of everything. So we do everything from Northern Nevada, from Washoe County and Carson City. In this case, we have one from Lyon County, which is the third judicial district and others. So when they're assigned to a panel, what we do is we read all the materials, the briefs. Our law clerks help do synopsis of the briefs, something called a bench memorandum, which is here, which is all the exhibits like the district court decision and key legal authority and some analysis. So we look at this and the briefs, and then before we have oral argument, we do some three of us a vote, and we determine, do we need to have oral argument, or do we need to, can we just read everything and have what we call a submitted case and just make the decision without oral argument? So like in these two cases today, the majority of the panel would have voted to orally argue the case, and that's why we're here today arguing it.
And Justice Douglas, after argument, what happens with the three of us?
Besides having dueling pistols and walking 10 paces of fire. We've heard the argument, we go back and we look at what we thought about the case originally and we discuss it. Each one will have their own opinion as to how the law and the facts come together. Following the argument, we'll take a tentative vote in terms of the outcome. Sometimes we're ready to decide a case right away. Other times we need additional questions answered. We will go back and look at the record. Sometimes we will look at the law in terms of we need a new memorandum as to a particular point of the law. Basically, what we're looking for today is why should we either affirm or why should we reverse the decision of the lower court. But again, the most interesting thing I found on the court is that sometimes we vote up a case and we think it should come with a particular outcome, but then you try to write it, and the devil's in the details. Sometimes the case just won't write, and you have to go back and say, why will it not write? And you dig back in, and you find something got missed someplace, and then you rewrite it. We normally, once we say it's submitted, we have so many days, usually 45 days, to get a decision out, and if one of the justices is dissenting, not agreeing with the other two, they have time to write their position for the record. And it's reviewed, and then it goes out to the world.
And this is a return for all three of us to the National Judicial College, as we were all district court judges in Clark County, and when you were, if you're a judge in Nevada, it's mandatory that you go to general jurisdiction. So I've spent three magnificent weeks up here, staying at Harris and then coming to the school every day. Justice Sato was with me, and Mark Denton is a district court judge, and Bill Voy was a district court judge, and Jim Hardesty was with us, and Jerry Pola from Reno. So it was a whole group of us that got to know each other, but also we met judges from all over the country. And I thought it was a great experience. I was also here in 92 and 93 when I was an alternate municipal judge on highway patrol scholarships for misdemeanor cases. But we're really thrilled to be here. The reason that we do this, what we call roadshow, is this man over here decided that because I ran unopposed in 2006, I needed to see rural Nevada. City, you name a place, we've been there thanks to Mark Gibbons. And we've been all over, and now Mike joins us. We were lucky enough before to have either Justice Fader, who's not retired, or Justice Pickering, so we had something for the females. So you're just going to have to excuse us and deal with the three males here. Our first case today is case number 68433, Comstock Residents Association versus Lyon County Board of Commissioners. And we've got Mr. Marshall for the appellant. Mr. Rye, who's with you?
This is Mr. Cavilia, counsel.
I'd like to welcome all of you for being here. And the advantage of doing a roadshow is that although the lawyers usually get 15 minutes each side, I allow them a chance to tell the audience what the case is about. So briefly, Mr. Marshall, if you would tell what your case is about. Mr. Ryan, you'll do the same thing. Go ahead, Mr. Marshall, and then we'll get into the legal argument.
This case really is about one of the critical functions of local government. And whether you know it or not, local government controls a lot of aspects of your life, and one of them is zoning and land use classifications and land use planning. So what this case is about is really a decision by the Lyon County Board of Commissioners to change the zoning for a piece of property owned by a mining company that is adjacent to Silver City, Nevada. Silver City, Nevada is in Lyon County, but it's also in the middle of the Comstock Historic District, the historic mining district. And the question that really the court is here to decide is, did Lyon County make a legal decision when it changed its zoning from not allowing mining as a use to adding mining as a use in a parcel right next to or inside the Silver City County boundaries? Without going into too much more detail, I think that sets the stage.
Mr. Ryan, what's your position in this case? Well, factual.
Good morning. Lyon County's position in this case is that the Board of County Commissioners acted appropriately in approving this master plan amendment and zone change. And as Mr. Marshall stated, local governments have broad authority in these issues, and that discretion should be able to be used without undue interference from other influences. So, in this case, the county considered the staff report, the Planning Commission decision, and numerous other items of evidence that were presented during the hearing, and reached the conclusion that Comstock Land Use application was appropriate before it and was justified by the evidence presented. And so we would ask that the district court affirm the decision of the county commission in this case.
Thank you. I'm ready to proceed, Mr. Marshall.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Marshall. I represent the appellants in this case, the Comstock Residents Association and Joe McCarthy. We are here to ask to overturn the decision of the District Court. Your review is de novo. You're reviewing, again, applying the same standard to the record that the District Court did. Silver City, the locus of this land use dispute is, sits in the middle of one of Nevada's and the nation's cultural icons, and that's the Comstock Historic District. The Nevada legislature has passed laws, the Congress has recognized the site as historic, as well as Lyon County and its master plan. Now, the occupants of Silver City are a range of characters. They're not many in number, but they are active citizens. And over the years, they have been actively engaged with Lyon County to ensure that several critical aspects with land use zoning occur within the town side of Silver City. And one of those key ones, which we're going to be talking about, is the separation of incompatible uses. Now, before the court are generally two sets of claims, the judicial review claims and the claims that were dismissed on the motion to dismiss. I'd like to start with a petition for judicial review and then end with the motion to dismiss that the court granted on two claims, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
So, first, the judicial petition for judicial review. Now, as counsel for Lyon County indicated, the standard here is deference to the local government in land use cases. What is critical here is what moves us out of that standard deference. And as we articulate in our briefs, and what I'd like to do quickly here is identify a number of factors, a number of red flags that are both recognized by courts, by the NRS, the Chapter 278, and are present here in the record, okay? And the first thing that I'd like to talk about is the character of the master plan. Now, this court's prior decisions have indicated that the master plan is due deference. It's not a straitjacket, but local governments have to act consistent with the direction of the master plan, okay? And in this case, the master plan, the 2010 master plan, was a culmination of a long process, a culmination of multiple events that led up to the assignation of uses and the division of uses between residential within the town site and mining potential outside, beyond. And that basic use dichotomy, separating those incompatible uses of existing residential and potential new mining. We're not talking about existing mining, but new mining uses. And that distinction started in 1971, was reinforced again when a mining company in 1986 requested the same land use changes to allow mining, potential mining use on the property. Again in 1990, when Lyon County adopted another master plan that again adopted the same dichotomy, the same separation of inconsistent uses. In 2002, Lyon County adopted a specific master plan for West Lyon County that strengthened those separation of uses. In 2010, after a 4 to 5 year process, Lyon County again adopted those same separation of uses, and in fact, increase the protection for Silver City because of its uniqueness, its location, and its character, and in fact expressly rejected a request by Comstock Mining Inc., CMI, to change the zoning to allow for a mining use. Now, you have your standard deference. We review those cases, or we review the decision of the of Lyon County Commission for under an arbitrary and capricious standard, substantial evidence. The definition of capriciousness is a sudden change in direction without justification. Now, this is the what I'd like to point out is when you see that, when you see a sudden flip, that is the red flag to say, what is going on here? Have you, where is the change? Because as we started our brief, land use zoning, one of the main purposes of it is to establish stability in uses. And if there is a change, it needs to be explained in order for it to be rational or non-capricious. Okay, that is one of the key findings. It's not that it's necessarily a requirement of law, although we think if you look at NRS 128.120.4, it establishes that you need to have, if you're going to amend the master plan, you need to have show change circumstances, right? But notwithstanding that, the fundamental concept here is that a decision can be arbitrary and capricious because you don't justify it as to why you're switching a long-held, repeatedly enforced position. That in and of itself is capricious. Now, I'd like to talk about for a minute how Lyon County got out of that kind of obvious problem that they have multiple inconsistent land use policies, right, that we've articulated in the briefs that separate those inconsistent uses, that recognize the uniqueness and character of the residents and the town of Silver City.
Can I focus you just a little bit?
Yes.
In our record, it indicates we had a number of speakers on both sides speaking for and speaking against. I guess the number is plus or minus three people in terms of for and against the two sides. The commissioners had to, they heard, they took under consideration what they had to say. But this is a master plan amendment. And it's covered by, I guess it's 270, 278, 227, so 4. And there's a requirement that it be sent out to the Planning Commission for some type of input. Now, the record indicates that they made the decision before sending it out to the Planning Commission. They sent it out to the Planning Commission sometime during the hearing. They got it back after they had made their decision, and all they did was say that, on the record, we received it. They didn't say they noted it. They didn't say they considered it. Should we be concerned because it was an amendment to the master plan that allowed them to do the zoning provision later?
Yes, very much so. And there's, I'd like to address two points that you made. One, I think the first point was there was an equal, some, you know, kind of equal number of in favor, a number against. To address that point, it is not, I think your prior cases make clear that it is not a vote. It is not a majority rule of the audience.
I understand
audience.
That, but that has, goes has to the issue be, of whether or not there's substantial evidence in the record. And
correct.
Something that
okay. Then let's quickly, then let's directly address your question regarding NRS 278.220.4, which has in it a direct policy that, because it really is part of the chain of the procedure for how you do master plans. In this case, the master plan first met the Planning Commission, the amendment. It was denied. It then went to the County Commission, and the County Commission changed, substantially changed the proposal. All right, that change under 278.220-4 requires that before it was adopted in final form, it had to be referred back to the Planning Commission in order, because the Planning Commission represents the expertise, the actual planning expertise, the more defined concrete planning expertise, and that reference back to a change that they have not deliberated on before is required by statute to occur before the Commission takes final action. In this case, they took final action. And then they referred it back And as you noted, they just accepted the report and did not take any other action. And in fact, already before they even took that vote, they indicated, they sent out their notice under NRS 278, I think it's 0235, that indicates that they've arrived at a final decision and your statute of limitations starts to run. So you can't have it both ways. You can't start your statute of limitations, say it's final, and then refer and take action. So that, in my mind, I'd like to...
You still have 5 minutes left.
Okay, I was going to refer, say that, but just as a quick transition out of that. What's critical also in this case in terms of the arbitrariness is the decision or the report and recommendation of the professional planner, their own planning staff, and their planning commission that voted and recommended against this plan amendment because it was inconsistent with the master plan. It didn't promote policies of the master plan, and the commission overturned without any explanation as to why. And again, that to me is the hallmark of arbitrary action.
So that's your primary concern, because the commissioners do have authority to make the final decision. They're not bound by the planning commission.
We do not contest that the commission has the discretion to make a decision, but it must exercise that discretion in a non-arbitrary fashion, a non-capricious fashion. In this case, they didn't do it. Primarily because the facts were in their favor, because what they were really trying to do was get mining as a use and not as a, the density, whole density issue is a red herring.
Did you want to comment on the conflict, possible conflict of interest of the commissioners or the violation of the open meeting law?
Yes.
And I'll give you a couple extra
minutes. Okay. First, the conflict of interest. This comes up in two different ways. Now we're focusing on the dismissal, I believe, of the open meeting law claims and the due process claims. The due process argument here really comes down to what the district court said, which was, I'm going to dismiss these claims because you have not alleged a violation of state law. And because you haven't alleged a violation of state law, you can't state a due process violation of the U.S. Constitution. All right. So all the evidence or allegations regarding undue influence of massive campaign contributions timed exactly to influence this upcoming decision, the hiring of a spouse of one of the commissioners, which means that there's a direct financial interest in of the commissioner in the contract right at the time it was about to expire. That those allegations can state a claim under the due process clause of both the U.S. and Nevada Constitution. It does not matter that there has to be an allegation of state law, because if you accept that theory, then you're running into violations of the supremacy clause and the separation of powers. It was also expressly recognized in both Caperton and Ivey that you can have legal campaign contributions and still result in a due process violation. So just because they may have disclosed the campaign contributions does not obviate or does not negate a claim under, as a matter of law, a claim under the due process clause.
And can I ask you, Caperton was a case involving the Supreme Court of West Virginia hearing a case. Isn't it different, though, for county commissioners and all like that? That related to the role of judges and whether they should participate in a case or not. County commissioners generally isn't the law. You have to do full disclosure and all, but then they're free to vote as the legislative body.
That what you're raising fundamentally is what does the due process clause apply to, right? Now, when you're an adjudicator, there may be heightened due process concerns, but there are still due process concerns with land use decisions. I think the court in various cases have held that when you have a property interest at stake, and the record reflects that the CRA members' property values are going to go down because of this action, that gives you a due process interest. It might be a little different than when you're adjudicating and let's say your life or liberty or interests are at stake. That means as to what process is due, not is there not due process. And I have not found a case that equates, again, the state law minimum with an automatic due process get out of jail, essentially.
Right. And Mr. Marsh, I can tell you, we had a case a number of years ago, it actually went to the United States Supreme Court from Washoe County, the case, and if I can just mention this because we have the students here and all, the county commissioner, I believe, was the campaign manager for a county commissioner, was proposing a casino variance for casino in Sparks, and the question was, could that, there was a disclosure and certain ethical issues is why it went to the U.S. Right. Supreme Court. But I know that it came up similar situation there, and ultimately the Supreme Court did rule on that. Is that type of case implicated here in this situation?
Very much so, because what the interest there was, you had a county commissioner whose campaign manager was appearing as a representative for another interest before the commission, and the commission then. City Council, ruled on that, and I think it was Mr. Kerrigan, he voted on that action and did not recuse himself. So what you had there was an interest in a friend, and there might have been some tangential financial interest. In this case, you have the spouse of one of the people sitting on the commission employed on a year-to-year contract, and then they don't recuse themselves for an action that has direct financial implications for the mining company, and then his contract is up right after the action taken by the Lyon County Commission. We feel that that is a direct ethical violation which gives rise to a due process claim.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Marshall, I'm going to give you 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I'm going to add to Mr. Ryan 3 minutes, so you have 18 minutes. Ordinarily, each side has 15 minutes, but because we asked some questions, and also I wanted the attorneys to make sure that you understood what the issues are, as Mr. Marshall just did, being the presiding justice, I can do that. I have the authority to give extra time. So, Mr. Ryan, you have 18 minutes, and then Mr. Marshall, you have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And if you, as long as we're on the issue of conflict of interest and open meeting law, would you start with that and then get into the other issues?
I will, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. The Comstock Residents Association has raised some open meeting law questions in this case. And there's primarily two issues that they raise. The first involves whether or not the agenda was clear and concise. And as this court has ruled on several occasions, the public needs to be apprised of what is going to be discussed. And there is no question in this case that the public knew what was going to be discussed. And how do you know that? You can review the record, the minutes of the meetings at both the Planning Commission and the County Commission. And there's no question with people coming up, what is it we're talking about? It was the same property discussed at both meetings. The agenda did not change from meeting to meeting. And it was clear and concise, just as the other planning items on that agenda, which you have in the record. And Sandoval, I think, makes it clear that that is the only requirement under the open meeting law, that it must be clear and concise. And there's things you can look at by analogy. What the argument is that, well, the Board of County Commissioners acted on less. The original request involved 87 acres, and the final request was only 72.4 or something like that. And they say, well, you can't do less. That's not the law. This court has never said that. The open meeting law does not say that. And it makes good sense. By analogy, if somebody presented a subdivision plot to the Board of County Commissioners and the Planning Commission, and it had 250 lots, and after discussion at the Planning Commission and the County Commission, it was decided that it would be better if it was 230 lots, would that be a violation of the open meeting law? We're talking about the same property. Similarly, in an open meeting law case, if the board talks about an item appropriating $1 million and they decide to appropriate $750,000, is that a violation of the open meeting law? No, because the public knows what is going to be discussed. And in this case, they clearly knew based on the agenda. The second issue they raise regarding the open meeting law is whether or not there was a serial communication or deliberation outside the convenes of the meeting. And there is no evidence of that. And as the court knows, you have to state a claim. If you don't do so, the district court properly dismissed. And that's what happened in this case. Because what you need to show is that there's, one, a serial communication, and two, deliberation. And none of the allegations support that. What you have in the complaint and the amended complaint that was proposed was a meeting that involved two county commissioners, the county manager, and a representative of the applicant. There's nothing to indicate any kind of deliberation toward a decision. And then you have another claim that another county commissioner contacted the applicant regarding a map. No communication between the three, so you don't get to a quorum. You don't get the serial meeting that you saw on Board of Regents, where all the regents communicated and then reached a decision. You have none of that here. And you also, I think in the Dewey case, the court made clear that staffing and briefings with individual commissioners are not illegal under the open meeting law. And that's all you have. Best case scenario, if you read the complaint and the amended complaint in favor of Comstock Residents Association, that's the best you can come to. And it doesn't amount to an open meeting law violation. With respect to the due process, the court has addressed a number of the issues which the county agrees with. And first of all, it is important that each county commissioner make disclosures. And they're detailed disclosures. They don't hide. The facts that Mr. Marshall gives to this court to justify it are exact facts that are in those disclosures. And as Justice Gibbons stated, the Nevada ethics laws clearly state that if you make a disclosure and you don't meet one of the three requirements, not only do you not have to recuse yourself, but the law says you must vote. You cannot recuse yourself because you think there may be a conflict of interest. You are required to vote under Nevada law. And in this case, the commissioners went through those, and they did not have a significant pecuniary interest in this master plan amendment or zone change. They did not have a personal relationship or interest that would be impacted by that. And they did not meet the other criteria. Now, the due process claim is legitimate, and the court considered that, but the district court believed that it was trumped by the Nevada ethics in this case. And you talk about the Massey-Capernaum case and the Ivy case, which you can use, I think, to reach the same conclusion that the district court did. As you know, in Massey, the Supreme Court said this is an exceptional case, and it was $3 million in contributions. They also said you need to look at the timing of when these contributions were made. It was when a case was pending and it was going to be decided. The campaign contributions in regard to Commissioner Hastings do not fit in that criteria. He had been elected but served as a county commissioner for 8 months at the time this application was filed, but for a year at the time it was considered. And so it's very different than that case. This is not an exceptional case. Also, the allegations in the complaint were that he received $17,500 in campaign contributions. They say that's a huge amount. It is significant in Lyon County, certainly, but is it huge? Is it exceptional? Does it disqualify the person from serving on the board and performing his function? No, and I don't think this court should make that kind of analysis gauged on just dollar amounts without looking at the overall facts, the disclosure that was made. And the Attorney General had said previously that campaign contributions alone do not require recusal.
Should the district court have waited as far as allowed discovery and then heard a motion for summary judgment rather than a motion to dismiss these claims?
Lyon County believes that the district court properly acted because there was no claim stated. And based on just the complaint, a motion to dismiss was proper. The other problem in this case is, as you know from planning 278 and planning decisions, the statute of limitations is very short because we want certainty in planning decisions, both for the county, for the community, and for developers, because they're economic decisions, they need to happen quickly. And by joining all these claims in really what amounts to a judicial review action, the case is delayed significantly. It will be nearly 3 years before this planning decision is finalized. That doesn't mean that the court should not consider proper claims, But in this case, I think it was appropriate to dismiss at that juncture because there was no claim stated.
Can I take you back somewhat? You talked about Kaepernick and the others, but as Justice Gibbons pointed out, the Kerrigan case is a little bit different because full disclosure was made in that case, and the U.S. Supreme Court said that a little more has to be viewed. Mm-hmm. Disclosure is not sufficient all by itself in terms of the spouse that was under contract or allegedly under contract during the decision-making period. Should we be concerned about that?
That's certainly a matter that the court should consider. But I think the facts and the record indicate that it's not a disqualifying relationship in this case.
Not clearly under the basic disclosure law, but as I said, when Kerrigan went up and came back, the Supreme Court seemed to say that for disqualifying purposes, we have to look a little further.
And again, I think that is the appropriate standard for the district court. But again, in this case, they looked at the complaint and the allegations and accepted those in favor of Comstock Residents Association and determined under those cases, that case, Ivy, Massey, that it did not meet the standard.
I understand Ivy and Massey very well, but
right.
Kerrigan is the one I'm having some problems with.
And
that's, again, a commission case, someone who had a direct relationship with a commissioner, influence that commissioner, and so that's why I raise it.
And that's a very legitimate question, Justice Douglas. The response from Lyon County would be that it's very different in this case. The applicant was not related to that commissioner. The contract, there was nothing alleged in the complaint that was contingent upon the master plan amendment and zone change that was before the board, nor was there anything in the record or in the complaint that there would be financial benefit to the family regardless of how that decision was made. It is merely speculative, and I think there was also issues as to whether or not the spouse was actually employed by Comstock Mining or a separate foundation, and just based on those allegations, it was appropriate to dismiss it at the district court level. Just want to address a couple. The judicial review is the primary crux of this case, and discretion means the freedom to decide what should be done in a particular situation, and Nevada law allows planning commission and county commissioners broad discretion in deciding what should happen with land use decisions. And that discretion, although not unfettered, should not be interfered with by courts. Really, the evaluation for you is there evidence to support what they did? Not is what they did wise, most beneficial. None of those things are really decisions for the court. Does the record support it? And there's three reasons in this case that it does. One, there's substantial evidence in the record. Two, the Planning Commission and the County Commission acted within their legal authority and properly exercised their discretion. And thirdly, they made the requisite findings as required by Chapter 278 and the Lyon County Code. And so, this discussion in the briefs and from Mr. Marshall about the history of the master plan and that it's been the same or similar for 40 years, and that's true. But that is true in many instances where the board authorizes a change in the master plan. And that is how development works, is that they plan with a general guideline and then they come up with changes. Property owners are allowed to present changes. They're difficult situations, and the boards are required to consider everything that's presented. That's exactly what happened in this case.
In this case, though, should we be concerned, and I'll give you an opportunity to respond since I asked a question to opposing counsel, as to the referral to the Planning Commission after their vote, and merely voting later to say we accept the report, not making any comment one way or the other, because there's an AGL opinion, 79-14, that talks about the requirement to receive the report from the Planning Commission before they make their decision, or at least reaffirming that they've reviewed it and ratifying their decision later. How do you respond?
Two responses to that, Justice Douglas. The first is that if you look at the record, And specifically, the staff report is referred to as the Planning Commission Report of Action. And that was presented to the Board of County Commissioners at January 2nd hearing. So arguably, they complied with NRS 278.220 at that time. Because when the board made its final decision on January 2nd, it had a report from the Planning Commission. They did not follow what that report said. They heard additional evidence, took testimony, had discussion.
What report did they have? Because the only indication I have from the record, and I might have missed it, was the Planning Commission's findings from the previous master plan, not the proposal to amend the master plan.
The report they had is in the appendix, page 108, it starts. And it is basically combined the staff report and the Planning Commission action. They also had copies of the minutes from the Planning Commission. I don't have the exact reference for that. But those items in conjunction would be, in our opinion, a report. The second point I would make on NRS 278-220 is that's not the only information you have. What happened was the board did refer it back to the Planning Commission, consistently with the county code and NRS, and the Planning Commission reconsidered it. Then it was again agendized to accept that report or consider that report on the county commission. And they did that. They voted on that, and I understand they voted to accept it. But there was very little public participation in that record. There were not applicants saying you should reconsider it, you should do anything else. And the reason for that is, under 278, the Board of County Commissioners has the final decision on a master plan amendment. And to think that after they make that decision, after both the Planning Commission and they have heard it, then you could go back to the Planning Commission and they would have to, the County Commission would have to rehear it. You get into a situation where you would go back and forth and never have a final decision.
Part of that is, should we be concerned because the record just reflects their vote was to accept, not that they've considered it, not that they reaffirm their prior decision to amend the master plan, even in light of that. And you're right, they do have the discretion to make the final vote. We don't contest that. But the question is, there's a procedure that's been laid out. This AGL's opinion that goes back to 1979 talks in terms of that and takes a position that it should be actually considered, not just received and stuck on the shelf.
And my response to that would be that it was considered. It was agendized as part of the county commission meeting. Public participation was called for. And so it went through that whole process. The actual vote of accepting it versus reviewing and accepting or other language, I think, is incidental and not part of that process. And I would also add, I mean, this is a belt and suspenders approach in this case, where it went to the Planning Commission not once but twice. And when it came back with that report the second time, the recommendation was essentially the same as before from the Planning Commission. They did not revise based on what the County Commission decided. So to do anything additional, to me, seems duplicative and unnecessary under the statute. As we pointed out, the record does contain substantial evidence, and the court has commented on that before, but what you had is a pretty extensive hearing, as you can tell from this record. Testimony given by engineers, surveyors, land use planners. The county commission considered the preservation of historic land uses, the preservation of the landmarks, suitability of the zone changes. They heard specifically from the Silver City Advisory Board, Comstock residents' attorney, environmental engineers, appraisers, mining consultants. They considered the environmental impacts, the compatibility of the changes to the area considered, and related to the master plan. Again, whether this court agrees or disagrees with the decision, it is obvious that the record contains plenty of evidence for the board to decide as it did. The board also made the findings that this change was consistent with the master plan goals, that it was compatible, that changed circumstances had occurred, and this was a more desirable use of the land, and that no adverse effects on the master plan goals would be incumbent upon this change, and it was consistent with the desired pattern of growth. They also made additional findings required by the county code, and these are in the staff report. And actually, if you read the staff report, there's a recommendation. If you want to approve, these are the findings that you could possibly consider. And each of those findings is supported in the record. But only one of those needs to be made. So if you find substantial evidence to support one, that is adequate to uphold the decision of the Board of County Commissioners. In summing up, I just, you know, land use decisions are discretionary, and they're varied, and they're very difficult. And not often are the answers easy. They're often controversial. And that is certainly true in this case. And if you look at the development of Nevada, especially in recent times, discretionary decisions have impacted its history. But those decisions are left to elected boards. They're not left to courts. They're not left to second guess. And it needs to be vested with those boards. And interference, as this court has said, should only be done when it's necessary. And in this case, we would submit that the board decision was proper, it was in accordance with Nevada law, and it's not necessary that the courts overturn that. Thank you.
Mr. Marshall, you have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to first start with the contention. The contention that, in fact, all the impacts associated with a range of uses was considered. And the actual testimony is that they were not. That the commissioners said that they were not considering the full range of municipal uses, only the allowed uses, not the special uses. So all the impacts, the environmental impacts that council just said were considered, were in fact not. And in their briefs, they say that all those considerations were irrelevant at that time. Our critical position is that you cannot approve a land use zoning that includes a range of uses and not look at the potential for those uses, because once you assign those uses to that property, there is a presumption, and this is the Nova Horizons case, a presumption that there is some compatibility there. So when you make that decision, when the local government makes that decision, they cannot put on blinders, as they did on this case. They expressly said, we're not going to consider that. And it's even more prejudicial here because they, in fact, actually considered what they alleged were the benefits of mining, but not the detriments and not the impacts on the citizens. And that is irrational, not only because it violates the law that you're not considering all the uses, but you only consider one side of the argument and not the other side. And it's reflective, in fact, of our due process claims, where you have demonstrated in the record hand in glove operation between members of the commission and the applicant CMI. At the same time, those commissioners are refusing to meet either with the other side or saying, I can't talk about it. At the same time, they're engaging in extensive discussions and plotting and planning about what they're going to do with the board. I'd like to address quickly the substantial evidence here, and what you heard was no reference to actual evidence, just a statement of there was substantial testimony, and there was testimony, but not actual evidence that supports it. I'll give you a great example. In their brief, in their answer brief at page 6, they cite an exhaustive technical report, including maps and analysis regarding CMI's application. And they give you a site, volume 2 at 288 through 373. That is the report that was filed 3 years before the application came in and looked exclusively at whether or not mining, the proposal to mine, to pit mine, across from Silver City was economically viable. It's an assessment of independent review and critique of mineral resources on the property. So the same evidence that they are saying, the same evidence that they are citing as supporting the application, in fact, is not about the application at all, and is about mining, the thing they say they can't talk about at the hearing. And that, we say, corrupts this case and we think mandates reversal
and remand back to Lyon County. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Marshall, Mr. Rye, for your arguments in this matter and your briefs. This case was submitted.